Hi, I'm Una Chaplin, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Hollywood Exiles. It tells the story of how my grandfather, Charlie Chaplin, and many others were caught up in a campaign to root out communism in Hollywood. Hollywood Exiles, from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
I interviewed a woman who's in the financial services sector in Canada, and she came on as anonymous. And she said, please, Sue, if my employers ever find out that I'm admitting to experiencing brain fog during menopause, I will lose my job.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we're hearing the case for understanding the menopause better, because understanding makes everything better for everyone. And I want you to meet the cycling mayor of Kilimani in Mozambique.
Wherever I go, I'm known as the biking mayor. The question when I won the election was like, what can I do for those who supported me, those cycling? So the first thing I did was to put traffic lights in the city. Imagine 5,000 bicycles without a single traffic light. There were accidents all over the place. And then last year, I put the first cycle lane in Mozambique. And now we are moving. We are indeed riding.
It's Thursday, the 8th of February. First, we go to a story about the death penalty on the continent. Around 50 years ago, the death penalty was standard all over the world. Then the movement to end it gained momentum. Today, around 75% of the nations of the world have abolished it. Angola, Mozambique, and Namibia started the ball rolling in 1990. Others, among them Sao Tome and Principe, Seychelles and South Africa followed in short order. Today, more countries than not carry out the death penalty, whether they have the law on their books or not. The latest country to begin proceedings to scrap the law is Zimbabwe, nearly two decades after the last execution. At independence in 1980, there were nine crimes punishable by death under the law. Now, Cabinet has decided to impose lengthy sentences for the worst offences instead. More countries are to follow. In fact, Africa seems to be leading the world on this. So what's behind this move to abolish the death penalty on the continent? I've been speaking to Pervez Jabbar, the co-executive director and co-founder of the Death Penalty Project here in London. We started with his reaction to Zimbabwe's decision.
We're obviously very, very pleased with the news coming out of Zimbabwe. It's welcome news. I should just clarify, the news is that the cabinet have approved, or the executive have approved, abolition of the death penalty. So it is not yet, it's not legislatively been abolished, but the bill still has to go through parliament. But the hope is that within the next few months, this process will be completed and the death penalty will be abolished in Zimbabwe.
Now, last year we saw Ghana doing the same in terms of the death penalty. Were you involved in either of those decisions?
Yes, we've been involved and worked very closely with partners and parliamentarians on the ground in Ghana. And as you say, they abolished the death penalty pretty much in the same way through the introduction of a private members bill. That was a very important example of something that has already been done that Zimbabwe is trying to do in a similar way.
Tell us what goes into building a case to abolish the death penalty.
Well, there are a number of things, I think. One is certainly the producing information and knowledge. So for countries that want to move away from the death penalty, there needs to be some recognition on the ground, a desire to move away. And then if there are questions about whether it can happen or how it should happen, there are two elements. One is the sort of technical expertise. How can it be done? How should it be done? And the other, I think, is what I would say is bringing the country along with you as you move away from abolition. So for that, I think some robust evidence, information and knowledge sharing is really, really important so that the population understand why a country is deciding to move away from this practice.
Is it difficult to wrest people away from the death penalty on their books? Because I know that a lot of countries around the world have a sort of hang 'em high sentiment that's quite strong within the population.
That's a good question. If I use Zimbabwe as an example, if one were to have conversations with parliamentarians, other leading members within the community, there might be a general recognition that even if they themselves want to abolish the death penalty, the public wouldn't support it. And those sentiments seem to be based on a feeling rather than, you know, strong empirical evidence, because what we did in Zimbabwe and we've done in other countries is we've said to key stakeholders, opinion formers, if you want to really understand what the public think, you need to ask them, you need to share information and give them material to think about. And what we found, we commissioned the University of Oxford to carry out some empirical research on this issue and other academics. And the Death Penalty Research Unit at the University of Oxford was instrumental in carrying out some research looking at both public opinion and opinion formers' views. What we found was that actually the majority of people who supported death penalty was not very high at all. In Zimbabwe, it was only 60%, 60, 61%.
But that's more than half, though.
It's more than half, but if you look at other countries around the world that have done this kind of, you know, research, you will get sort of statistics around 80, 90%. When the United Kingdom abolished the death penalty in the 1960s, support for the death penalty would have been about 85, 90%. So it's usually very, very high, but the very interesting statistic within that is that when 61% number was asked, if the government were to abolish the death penalty, would you accept it? 81% of Zimbabweans in Zimbabwe said, we would accept it because that's what we expect the government to do. It's government policy and we would accept it. So you can't just look at the binary data, those in favor and those against. You have to look a little bit more under the skin, so to speak, and get sort of more detail. And then you can find real views as to whether there's a strong retention or a strong favor of retention or otherwise. So I think that's quite interesting.
Let me ask you this. There are 30 countries in Africa that still have the death penalty on their books and enforce it. 16 of these states or territories have not executed anyone in the past decade. So are we moving in the direction of losing the death penalty in African countries? And is that the direction that the world is going in as well?
Yes. Well, I mean, if you look at the, if you look at it in global terms, 75% of the world has now moved away from execution. So they're either abolitionist or they're what we call abolitionist de facto. And perhaps I should explain what that means. That is, abolitionist de facto is a definition for a country that has not executed in over 10 years. So they haven't abolished, but they haven't carried out any executions. They're considered abolitionist de facto. So two-thirds of the world has moved away from the death penalty. If you look at it 40 years, 50 years ago, two-thirds of the world had it. Now, if you look at, if you go into the African Union itself, what you see now is a continent that is in super dynamic in terms of the movement towards abolition. So you're right in terms of the stats. 29 countries have abolished the death penalty in the African Union, 54 states, but a further 18 are what we have described as abolitionist de facto. So in fact, there are only 7 retentionist states in the African Union: Botswana, Egypt, Libya, Nigeria, Somalia, South Sudan, and Sudan. So the movement in the African Union has been phenomenal. And obviously in the last few years, you've seen Zambia abolish, Central African Republic abolish, Sierra Leone and Zambia, which you mentioned earlier. So I can see a stage where the African Union will be death penalty free.
Egypt, Sudan, Libya, and Somalia are Muslim countries, and they have the death penalty. Those are the 4 countries that are included in the ones where the death penalty is regularly deployed. But for instance, the youngest country in Africa, South Sudan has it, Ethiopia has it, the Democratic Republic of Congo. Nigeria might also have the religious element. So religion is definitely one of them, right? Is culture in a different sense the other, or is it just how the law came onto the books in that country? I'm really interested in the differences.
There is definitely something along the lines of colonial legacy, for sure. If you think of most of the Commonwealth jurisdictions, it's true that there is historical legacy from colonial times. The death penalty was introduced at the time of colonization. And in many of those jurisdictions, if you look at Zimbabwe, for example, Zimbabweans would argue that before colonization, the death penalty didn't exist in Zimbabwe, and it was true. They had different forms of practice in terms of punishment and so on, administered by village elders and communities and so on. But it's also true to say that some of those practices now would also be condemned as not compatible with the modern world. So there is certainly some concept of colonialism there. And I think that's what you're also seeing in terms of the countries that are moving away. It is also a reflection, perhaps, that these countries want to separate from those times and see abolition of the death penalty as a marker in that sense to different values from earlier times.
Now let's address the fact that African countries are moving away from it so rapidly. The United States, though, is often in the news concerning the death penalty. Why is the U.S. an outlier in that regard? Because other countries, shall we call them developed democracies, don't have the death penalty. The U.S. does.
I think the U.S. being a retentionist country is problematic. It becomes more difficult to talk about abolition in a global context when, as you say, one of the most developed countries in the world still retains it. Japan also still retains it in terms of first world, developed world countries. But I think it's wrong to describe the US as retentionist. There are some 23 states now, I think, of the 50 have abolished. There are 14 states when there have been no executions in the last 10 years. And I think the statistics from Amnesty International's 2022 report, which is the most recent, there were only 18 executions in six states. So the picture is not as black and white as it's a death penalty country, because within there are many states that do not execute. But it's true to say it creates a problem. And there are some states like Texas, Florida, etc., where execution or death sentence rates are very, very high. But I think it's wrong to paint it as one whole country in that sense.
Now, the countries that do have the death penalty, China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the US, again, those are very, very different countries as well, to have this particular thing in common. And of course, Japan. What does that tell us about the death penalty itself?
The history, as I mentioned, it may have existed. It's remained on the book. So if you look at a number of these countries, perhaps not the ones you mentioned, but there are so many countries that are considered ADF. So they have the death penalty on their statute books, but they do not actually inflict the punishment. They do not execute. So in a sense, they don't really use the death penalty. Kenya is another country in which I do a lot of work. It hasn't executed anybody in over 30 years, but it still retains the death penalty. So the conversation that we need to be having sometimes isn't so much as looking at countries that have it still on their statute books, but how they develop or how they approach it in practice. And that's where I think some of the conversations on abolition become quite important, because the conversation you're having is not you execute thousands as we understand China does. Moving China to abolition is a much bigger, harder step than a country like Kenya that hasn't executed in 35 years. And then I think the other element is that many of the countries that still have the death penalty, they execute very, very few. So even those that do execute, the numbers are very, very small. Botswana, for example, is a retentionist state, has executed in recent years, but the numbers are one or two. You know, they're not big numbers. That is a different conversation to a country like Iran or Saudi Arabia or China or even the US. So I think the conversation that we need to have is slightly more nuanced. But in terms of why they have it historically, of course, the question to ask is why countries are moving away. And sometimes I think it's a reflection of that country's desire to see itself with different values. It's an example of a country that says that a modern criminal justice system shouldn't allow the death penalty to be on the books as a possible punishment. So there are many reasons that go into it. There are the contemporary examples where there's a terrible crime or terrorist atrocity that obviously has an impact as to its movement.
That's Parvez Jabbar, co-executive director and co-founder of the Death Penalty Project based here in London. Now, if I said the word menopause, what comes to your mind? For those who've experienced it, hot flushes, weight gain, maybe even a form of post-traumatic stress disorder, and I am not joking. For those who have not, maybe no reaction whatsoever. A quick Google search brings up this definition under the heading Menopause Stereotypes. Middle-aged, angry or moody women sitting in the corner, fanning themselves, and it's a subject that makes others feel uncomfortable if you talk about it. Well, that's why we are talking about it. A recent article in the UK's Guardian newspaper addressed the issue with specific reference to menopause in Africa. It was written by Sumbaya, and she wrote, "It's unacceptable that so many women across Africa find themselves unprepared for the complicated mix of symptoms associated with menopause. Not talking harms women." And that's the end of the quote. Sue is the founder and director of Menopause Solutions Africa and host of the Pause for Menopause podcast.
You know, Pause for Menopause podcast was my very first initiative involving menopause. And Pause for Menopause podcast is now, we're preparing for season 5 of the podcast.
What is menopause?
Let's start with the medical definition. I mean, menopause is about the time when women's bodies stop going through the menstrual cycle and those monthly periods. That really is what menopause is all about. And it's defined as, 12 months after your last menstrual period. So it's for sure that you've stopped having your menses. But in reality, menopause is so many different things, because ultimately, the stop in your menstrual periods happens a lot to do with the decline of estrogen in your system. But here's the thing. Estrogen is responsible for so many other things in a woman's body over and above just her menstrual periods. You know, it regulates brain function, cardiac function, the production and the proper functioning of a whole host of hormones.
You wrote an article in the Guardian newspaper here in the UK, and one of the things that you say there is that it's unacceptable that so many women across Africa find themselves unprepared for the complicated mix of symptoms associated with menopause. And you say not talking harms women. How does it harm women? And well, let's talk about Africa. I suppose you're talking about awareness of menopause and the impact that it has on the life.
Unfortunately, there's a common thread that runs through most cultures and most societies in Africa and in elsewhere in the world, and that's about patriarchy, which informs the rules by which women are valued. So a lot of the time, women are valued for the roles that they play in society, mostly childbearing, but also about your looks, your beauty, your sex appeal. All of these are cultural constructs that inform how a woman is valued. And guess what? Menopause messes with all of those values that are normally ascribed to what a good woman looks like. And so the lack of education, which prevails around menopause, means that those misconceptions, the false distinctions, and the superstitions that come from those cultural, constructs continue to prevail even in modern day.
Is menopause stigmatized?
Absolutely. Menopause is stigmatized in the villages of Africa as much as it is stigmatized in the corporate boardrooms in the most advanced societies. And so that's why you see across the globe, and I think the UK is leading together with countries like Australia, across the globe, you're seeing this drive, this wave to say, let's normalize menopause. Let's talk about it. And why is it that women haven't received the support that they needed so far? Because they didn't dare come forward to say, hey, this is what I'm going through. In season two of the podcast, I interviewed a woman who's in the financial services sector in Canada, and she came on as anonymous. And she said, please, Sue, if my employers ever find out that I'm admitting to experiencing brain fog during menopause, I will lose my job.
Was it ever thus? Was it always stigmatized?
I can speak authoritatively about societies in Africa, right? So it's quite a paradox, because on the one hand, in many societies, menopause is this thing that you can't talk about. It's not openly spoken about. But on the other hand, in a few societies, you find that there is a particular status that is afforded to women who are now postmenopausal. You find older women can sit in the council of elders, which is reserved for men. But let's roll back and then say, so is that because they're seen as having achieved something, or that they're no longer associated with a condition that's actually stigmatized?
Maybe women talk about it among themselves. Does that not happen?
The only study that I've seen that referred to how often women talk to each other about menopause says about 10% of women say that their mothers spoke to them about menopause.
Now, I'm wondering, young women, men listening to this, thinking, why does this matter to me? It doesn't affect me. I'm not there yet. And you know how young people think, you know, they're never going to get older. So why does it matter to everyone that we have this conversation?
Well, you know, so two different things. So for younger women, the way that you think about and prepare for menopause when you are 21, 25, 27, has a huge implication on the type of experience that you will have with menopause, right? At the most selfish personal level, you should care about menopause, because if you inform yourself and make certain decisions about exercise, diet, what you consume, you know, as a younger woman, it impacts your experience with menopause later. And of course, there's solidarity with those who are going through menopause. That's important. What about a man? I think that the best place to demonstrate the relevance of menopause to men is when we look at how menopause impacts men in the workplace. And this is an area where I work a lot as Menopause Solutions Africa. Men are co-workers, they are managers, they are business owners of entities that employ women who will go through menopause. We live in an age where we have the highest proportion of menopausal women present in the workplace. So menopause has become a workplace reality, and that's why men should be concerned about menopause as well.
I'm going to say this as a slogan. We are menopausal women. What do we want?
We need champions at all levels, whether they're young women or whether they are men, who will challenge societal norms that have entrenched the stigma around menopause. Champions who will lead the charge in advocating for change. And so what kind of change do we want to see? Well, first of all, we want to teach it, we want to acknowledge it, and we want to pay for it. What do I mean by that? Curricula need to change, not just in high schools, medical doctors across the board. I talk to doctors in all parts of the world that say the maximum that you will get, lessons or lectures on menopause as a medical student is two or three lectures. Can you imagine? So we need to inform our healthcare providers. We need to acknowledge menopause in our policies and processes right from company to country level. Then we need to pay for it. We need to make available the resources that are required for all these changes to take place, whether it's research, whether it's our doctors learning about it, whether it's making sure that there's information available, or whether it's making sure that the products that companies produce are modified to take menopause considerations into place.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed this conversation.
Audrey, thank you for having me.
Sue Mbaya from Menopause Solutions Africa and the podcast Pause for Menopause. Find it and subscribe. And while you're at it, find and subscribe to Focus on Africa as well. You won't regret it. Now, I want you to meet a man who was talked into running for mayor of Kilimani, one of the biggest cities in Mozambique. He said okay, expecting to lose, but he didn't. Not only did he not lose, he's just been sworn in for a fourth term. So how did Manuel de Araújo do it? On a bicycle, apparently, supported by commercial cyclists. And now he's determined to make Kilimani the most sustainable city in Africa, if not one of the most sustainable cities in the world. More than a decade since his first win back in 2011, he's been recognized by the global network Local Governments for Sustainability as one of only four recipients of the World Mayor Jury Award for his defense of democratic values in Mozambique and his sustainability initiatives. It's not been smooth sailing, though. The mayor says he survived an assassination attempt in the last elections. When we spoke, Manuel de Araújo was just about to be sworn in once again as mayor of Kilimani. Well, you're having a very busy day.
Oh, yes. Today is like one of the busiest days in my whole life, I think I could say.
Well, I'm very pleased that we're sharing a part of this busy day with you. It's a pleasure, and it's definitely one of those things that I didn't imagine would be happening. So I'm very pleased. Congratulations. Is this your third term in as mayor?
Unfortunately, it's my fourth term.
Unfortunately for who?
For me, because I had to stop my dreams and do what people wanted me to do. So,
oh, were you an unwilling mayor back in 2010, 2011, yes, when you became mayor? Tell us why.
Well, I was still finishing my PhD at the University of East Anglia in UK, so I was writing my dissertation. While I was doing that, I was coming back and forth. Unfortunately, or fortunately, the then mayor, he was sacked on corruption charges, and so new elections were called. So people were like, well, you know, why don't you run? I was like, no.
So who twisted your arm?
Well, first of all, we're just friends, but at the end, it was my dad. So my dad asked me one question. Why did we send you to school? I said, well, would you send me to school for me to study? I said, to study for what? That question was like a punch in my stomach. From there onwards, I couldn't say no. So, yeah.
Why did everybody think that you would make a good mayor?
That's a question I'm still looking for answers. But anyway, I've got some theories. One is that because people saw me like bringing in investment, like, wow, there are many people who leave this city going either to university or to work abroad, but there are very few who come back with an investment.
So there you were. I'm twisted into being the mayor. What was the deciding factor for you? You said, okay, fine, I'll do this.
Yeah, I had to convince myself, but actually I wasn't sure that I would make it. So one of the things which made me run, I believed really that I will lose. So I said, okay, I will run, I'll lose, then I go back to London. Unfortunately, I won.
And you didn't run, you actually rode on a bike. One of the things that you decided to do was to make cycling one of the center points of your campaign.
I went into mobility or sustainable mobility or cycling from the back door because it was not a conscious decision about the environment, actually. When I asked my team, what will it cost me to run? I saw that the biggest item on the budget was fuel, because at that time, all the people campaigning to show that they have a lot of support, they will give people free fuel. Then those people will take either their motor or their cars and make a lining. So that one, the way to show that you have got a lot of support. But then I thought, if I cut this expense, the budget will be bearable. So I took it off and I said, okay, how can we make a campaign without using fuel? The answer was either by walking or by biking. And because my city is the capital of biking, so I went into biking.
So biking is already an established tradition in Kilimani.
Oh, yes. People use it as a taxi. They carry goods and they carry people from one place to the other. So it was already established, but it wasn't in the mainstream politics. In the other words, those are cycling were seeing themselves and the people were seeing them as third-class citizens, as the poor. And by using bicycle in my campaigning, I changed that perception. Today, biking is a fashion in my city, not only in my city. Wherever I go, I'm known as the biking mayor. The question when I won the election was like, what can I do for those who supported me, those cycling? So the first thing I did was to put traffic lights in the city. Imagine 5,000 bicycles without a single traffic light. There were accidents all over the place. So I decided to put traffic lights. And then last year, I put the first cycle lane in Mozambique. And from there, we won actually the Bloomberg competition. We got $400,000. And now we are moving. We are indeed riding.
And what about those people who thought that people who cycle are third-class citizens. In fact, I'm wondering about the people in Kilimani themselves who were on those bikes. Did they think this guy is not serious, or did they think actually this guy is for us?
At the beginning, they thought that I was crazy. Literally, they called me the mad mayor. So I moved from the mad mayor to the biking mayor. That was a transformation. The other challenge I had was like every accident that was happening in my town, municipal police would blame always, and public opinion too, would always blame the cyclists, even when it was not true. So I had to change that because as a mayor, I am the commander in chief of the municipal police. So I personally, because I had worked for Amnesty International in human rights and so on, so I used that experience to transform the police force into a police service in Kilimani and making cyclists the first class citizens as I thought that they should be.
I think it's one of those things that takes a deep mindset shift. But you are also looking at sustainability, right? And making people's personal lives to be more sustainable. What are your plans in that regard, and how are they being received?
Well, in my regard, as you may know, on the 11th and 12th of March last year, 2023, Kilimani was hit by Cyclone Freddy, which was, I mean, recorded as the longest living cyclone in the world. And it literally destroyed my city. All the improvement that we had made in infrastructure, in tree planting and so on, they were destroyed overnight. So we now designed a plan to make my city sustainable. So every move we make, be it in sports, be it in infrastructure, be it in building, whatever, we make sure those things are sustainable and they are environmental fit. I'm running a campaign called One Citizen, Two Trees, because we have around 500 citizens in Kilimani. Our aim is to plant 1 million trees.
500,000 citizens, right? Not 500.
Yes. If each of us plants two trees, then that will make 1 million trees. That's like one of the things we're doing. The other one, with the Bloomberg money, which is $400,000, we are now building 5 kilometers of cycle line. We are also improving the pavement for walking and cycling. But also we got a World Bank project to build water, residuous water treatment plant, but also we have a very important project on mangrove planting.
Tell us more. Hello?
Sorry, the judge is calling me. I will have to stop now.
Manuel de Araujo, the cycling mayor of Kilimani, had to go before we could discuss allegations that there was an attempt to assassinate him during the last election. Focus on Africa was compiled by Bella Hassan, Daniel Dadzi, and Yvette Twagira Maria here in London. Carney Sharp supervised activities. Philip Bull was our technical producer. Alice Muthengi is the editor. I'm Audrey Brown, the one doing the talking. Thanks for listening.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student-athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when you did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.